Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Stephen Nisbet. Stephen is an Air Force veteran and the president of Shields and Stripes, a nonprofit which takes a holistic mind-body approach to helping veterans and first responders heal. And in this episode, we're going to chat with Stephen about his experiences in the military and what Shields and Stripes is all about and how it can help people who are looking to get into a more of a holistic mind-body kind of approach to their healing journey. So welcome to the show, Stephen. Glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. It's my pleasure. And hopefully we don't keep it too boring and we keep it interesting and for your listeners. And then we can say some things that hopefully spark some opportunity for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think we're going to have a problem with that. I think we're going to talk about some pretty great stuff that you guys have going on and how you're out there helping out the veterans and the first responders who are struggling in one way or another and how you've taken this approach to really help heal their overall, their mind, their body, that everything that they have going on. So I don't think we'll have any issue with it being a boring conversation here. So first off, let's take things back a little bit. And you know, would you be able to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So 36 years old, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. Growing up, my dad was in the Air Force. He spent several years in the Air Force's security forces. And then he got out and became a police officer. So he spent pretty much the next 30 years in law enforcement, my entire childhood and beyond, as a police officer and specifically in the gang task force unit. So as I grew up, it was, you know, a pretty strict household, if you will. And it's not that I had there was no like terrible upbringing or anything like that. It was just making sure that we didn't do anything, me and my brothers and I didn't do anything to tarnish his name or his reputation. You know, there's a lot of individuals or kids at the school that I hung out with that he arrested, and he knew a lot of things about a lot of the people that I hung out with. And so it made it a challenge in school being the son of a police officer. Spent my childhood playing soccer and beyond, doing, you know, that was my sport that I really wanted to get into. I wanted to go to college playing soccer. That was a goal and an aspiration. And as I finished high school, that never came. I didn't get a scholarship to go to play soccer somewhere in, you know, specifically the University of Arizona there, or even Pima Community College. And it was at a point of, well, what do I do now? What do I do next? And so I went to school. I went to Pima Community College after high school. And I went and studied astronomy because I was a space nerd and still am. But that's what I like to do. I like to look at space. And as I went into the classes there, I looked around at the people around me. And it's no dig on them. It just wasn't the demographic that I, you know, want to hang out with. There were a lot of older folks that just weren't my speed. And I was like, man, there's a lot more stuff I could be doing. And started looking at different options. All of my friends actually were going to the University of Arizona, so I felt super inadequate. And they were all going in as engineers under scholarships. And I was like, man, I don't have the money to pay for that. Still want to hang out with my friends. Not really into engineering, but out there, I know they're going to make a lot of money doing that. And in my mind, the goal was that I can find a way to make money and go move out of my house and do something different. So I was like, you know what? Like, here's another avenue where maybe I can get to where they are just by a different means. And I'm going to go just join the Air Force because I talked about it with my dad. He said, you know, the Air Force is going to be where you want to go. It's, you know, they take care of you better, as they say. And I didn't disagree. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll just go do that. I'm going to go do that for 4 years and I'm going to get the GI Bill. And then I'm going to then I'll have my scholarship and go to the U of A and catch up and then go work with them at Raytheon or IBM or whatever. And we'll be best pals again. So I went into the office, the recruiter's office there in Tucson. And I'd taken the ASVAB and I scored really well. And I'm like, you know, so you can do anything you want. what do you want to do? I was like, well, what's a difficult job that you need to have a high ASVAB score? And like a nuclear weapons apprentice. And I was like, that's perfect. That'll land me right up to working with Raytheon or IBM and stuff. I'll build some missile systems with them. And, you know, I'll be back in Tucson hanging out with my buds. And so that was it. I pretty much signed paperwork. This is what I want to do. Walked out of the office and there was an Army recruiter next door. He was like, hey, son, let me talk to you. And I was like, we're listening to what he has to say. And so I listened to him and he said, you want to be in Special Forces? And I was like, yeah, I've never even thought of that. No one's ever asked me that question. I never even considered that for myself. And I listened to everything he had to say. And I was like, I can't believe somebody's asking me if I want to be in Special Forces. Like, I want to be special in some way. I was like, man, that sounds really appealing. And I didn't consider myself special in any way. I was like, hang on a second. I might be back. He also dangled some money in front of my face. You know, for an enlistment bonus. And I was like, that sounds pretty appealing.
And so recruiters do.
Yeah. And so I went into the Air Force office and I was like, hey, you guys got any special operations jobs? Right. You already chose nuclear weapons apprentice. Just stick with that. Stick with what you got. And I was like, yeah, I know, but I just listened to this dude. And he says they got special forces. Do you guys have special operations jobs? And he's like, yeah, we got PJs and combat controllers. But here's the thing. You're not going to make it. Like, it's so hard to become one of these. It's a 90% attrition rate. If just stick with what you have and you'll like have to worry about then changing your career field because you probably won't make it. You know, the odds are. And I was like, this guy has no clue who I am. Like, how is he going to tell me without knowing anything about me? I was like, just give me the information. So he gave me some information, walked out of there, canceled any paperwork that I had signed that day, did my research. And I was like, I want to become a combat controller after reading both of the career fields. And I was like, I don't really know what it does per se based on the information they gave me, but combat control. I like the sound of combat and controlling combat. So that sounds appealing. I'm going to go do that. And so I started training for it. Signed some paperwork and took a pass test for the physical ability and stamina test. And that's just a regular PT test just to see, hey, you meet standards to be able to join this type of career field. And when I went to take it, they said, all right, which one do you want to do first? Or which one do you want to do? And I was like, what are you talking about? And they're like, you either have a good swim in the beginning or the swim at the end. And I was like, I'll just swim at the beginning. Does it matter? And they're like, no, not really. And I was like, okay, well, I've been training with swim at the beginning. So that's what I'll do. Swam, did the whole thing. And then they're like, all right, you're going to be a PJ. And I was like, I thought I wanted to be a combat controller. Like, it's the same thing. When you get there, when you get to basic training, you just tell them you want to be this and then you move on and then you go to the same in-doc course and you figure it out from there. And I believe this guy. And I was like, okay, sounds good. That's not what happened. I showed up there and the two... It used to be a pipeline that was together and now it's separated. And this was in 2005. It's separated to PJs and controllers, the different pipelines. And they kind of intermixed throughout that pipeline, but it was always a different path. And so I started doing research and I was like, you know what? Maybe I will do PJ stuff. But I was more interested in like, all right, if I'm going to do this, the plan remained the same. I'm still going to get out in 4 years. I go hang out with my buds and do schooling, but I'm going to do a crew job first. And I'm going to rescue. I was more interested in rescuing civilians, like, you know, out in the, like lost in the Grand Canyon or something like that, or injured civilians. And I was like, that sounds more interesting to me. I wasn't into the combat thing. And so I did the pipeline, finished. 120 people started in my class and only 12 of us finished. You know, in the beginning, when every single step I took, I was 120 pounds soaking wet, 130 pounds. And one of the smallest guys in the group. And, you know, in my basic training class, there's 30 of us going through. And I would go to sleep at night. I would lay in the, and these other guys are doing extra push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups. They're just really training hard at night. And I was like, I'm too tired for any of that stuff. I'm going to sleep. And so my basic training instructor was like, you're not going to make it. You're going to be the one to quit first. And I was like, I don't know about, like, these guys are pretty big and they look strong and fast and stuff. But like, I just like to sleep and recover. And so maybe this guy's right. I don't know, but we did the course, you know, it went into indoc, and of those 30 people that were in that group of 120, I was the only one of those 30 to finish and all of the other ones quit. And so it was very gratifying, you know, just to watch each one of them, as terrible as it was for them to make a choice to quit. It was motivating for me to see each, like, the pool gets, like, the people inside the pool get smaller and smaller. And so, like, I have more space in the pool and, you know, there's less people to have to carry. And so it's just watching, I don't know, it was like a motivating factor of, like, there's another one. And like, I'm still charging and you look to see who's performing the worst. And like, at least my day is not as bad as that guy's day. It was bad when I looked around and nobody else was suffering more than I was. And I was like, oh, well, that's a problem. But nonetheless, subject of being told that it's too hard and you're going to quit or you're going to fail, that became the mantra of the rest of my career and even to now. And I still look back on those days. Who are these people to tell me I'm not good enough or I'm not going to make it or it's too hard? So ended up joining, making it, becoming a PJ, a para rescue man, and did that for 16 years. And over that 16 years, deployed 10 times. The original goal of going back and hanging out with my buds in Tucson, that became a thing of the past. And this became my new passion after my first deployment in 2010 out to Afghanistan. And it was a very busy deployment. And even though I was doing CSAR for a task force, that particular CSAR rotation in 2010, we saw a lot of casualties. We had a lot of base attacks. You know, that was the first time getting shot at, you know, third day in country of us knowing what a bullet sounds like going by you and having that feeling of like, okay, somebody's on the other end of that looking at me and wanting to end my life. And so that was a realization of like, okay, this is combat. And then it became more of like, I want more of that, where my old mindset was I want to do rescue for civilians who are out, you know, getting lost or hurt somewhere. Now it was, there's evil out there and there's bad people that don't need to be around anymore. And so that became the next, I guess, addiction of deploying and scratching that itch, going and helping good people, removing evil from the earth and continuing to do that over and over again.
I love hearing the stories of resilience, like what you're talking about there, where someone tells you now that you're either not strong enough, you're not fast enough, you're not smart enough, whatever the case may be. And you look at them and like, well, who the hell are you? Right. And let's get this done. Like, yes, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to do this only because you told me that I can't do it. And I'm going to just do it 1,000 times harder now because you told me that I can't do it. I'm absolutely going to accomplish this goal. And I love hearing those kind of stories because it's kind of just like a big middle finger up to the people who are telling you that you can't do it. It's like, yeah, screw you. I'm going to do this anyways. Right.
Well, I see it coming from people that never tried. From people that,
there you go.
Yeah. They're the ones to tell me that what I'm going to do is like, well, okay, I'm going to take what you say with a grain of salt because you never put your chips on the table. You never put your, you know, bowl in the fire. You never do any of that stuff. So,
right.
Well, who are you to tell me that negative attitude?
Yeah. And the statistics may be correct. And it seems like it was correct in your case because you said there's 120 people in your class and only 12 made it all the way through. So that 90-10 split seems like that was an accurate number there. But who is he to tell you that you wouldn't be one of those 12 people who made it all the way through? So like, that's a bunch of crap. Like, no, if someone wants to do this, they're going to be a whole lot more motivated to do it than someone who's just like, oh yeah, sure, let's just pick a thing and let's go with it. And then they realize how hard it is both physically and mentally. And then they quit because they didn't really know anything about it. Right. But you at least took some time to figure out what it was that you wanted to do. And you're like, no, absolutely. This is what I want to do. So that to me gives you a leg up on some of these other people who maybe weren't even really sure what they were getting themselves into, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I did some research. We were watching videos and some movies and documentaries and whatnot. And so I was prepared for what was about to come. And I practiced and I trained before getting there. I devoted a lot of time and discipline and effort into getting there. And one of my favorite quotes is from one of my in-doc instructors who absolutely heinous, massive mountain of a man. But his quote was, you know, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight dog. Yeah. And so that, you know, really stuck with me because I was one of the smallest guys on the team, but of everybody, you know, didn't matter about size. I was still carrying 220 pound people that were almost double my weight. And, you know, it's just, how much grit and will do you have to succeed?
Yeah, exactly. You can do just about anything you set your mind to, as far as physical strength type things, like you can accomplish these types of things carrying a mountain of a man on your back. You can do it. You know, you just got to put your mind to it. Right. Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit. I'm sure you probably have some stories about deployments and things like that, but let's fast forward a little bit and talk about your transition out of the military. And what were some of the events that led up to your decision to get out? I know you said, I think it was 16 years that you spent in there. So, you know, I'm sure at some point you're probably eyeing that 20 years and you're probably thinking that was going to be it in your future, but what led up to your decision to get out, and what was life for you after getting out of the military?
Yeah, so I was prepared. Yeah, that was the goal, was make it to 20 and then do your typical regular retirement, get out and move forward. And I had a goal and a plan of where I wanted to be. And after, you know, nine deployments now, and having lost lots of friends to various situations, whether it be accidents, whether it be combat or suicide, I lost a lot. And I was very used to losing friends. And I started normalizing the loss. I started normalizing where the transition of who I was to who I am now and my reaction to things. In our job, especially as a PJ and you're doing rescue deployments in combat, we were going from the highs to lows very quickly. You know, we had 8 minutes to get our stuff from call, reading the 9-line, getting your stuff on, getting on the helicopter, taking off. We had 8 to 10 minutes to take from receiving the mission to taking off, going to wherever it was, coming back. And off, you know, offloading, whatever, refitting, re-kitting, and then getting ready for the next one. It was just ups and downs over and over for multiple deployments. And so it became easy for me to do that in my regular day-to-day life. You know, when my kids would get upset and this, I was more stressed out at home with my kids than I was getting shot at in combat, because I know how to respond in combat. I don't know how to respond appropriately to kids screaming and crying. And so it was very easy for me to just snap and raise my voice to get what I wanted, because now I could scare them into stopping. And so after doing that over and over again, and leaving and coming back and not remembering specific things in my personal life and in professional life, people that I've known for 10 years, I can't remember their names. It's from everybody. It's just zoning out, pushing my kids on the swing, not really paying attention to them. I started to really question what or why it wasn't happening. Why were these things happening to me? And I started to try to attribute it to TBIs. I got, too many explosions in every, too many firefights, too many knocks on the head or whatever. I need to go get my brain checked out. Went and got an MRI, checked it out. Everything came back normal. And I was like, something ain't normal upstairs, because I can't remember a single thing about people I've known for 10 years. I recognize people and they come up and talk to me. I don't know their names or how I even know them. So what is going on? And kind of talked about it with the psych a little bit. And she recommended that I do some therapy. And I was like, I don't have PTSD. I don't have that. I don't need that type of therapy. And then sitting down one night after putting the kids to bed and having a little bit of irritability that night, my wife had sat me down and said, hey, I don't mean to make you upset, or, I love you and I care about you very much, but your boys are very scared of you and they're afraid anytime they do something that you're going to get upset and, yell at them. And that was, wow, what a kick to the gut. And that hurt. And it took a lot of courage for her to say that. And so I was like, okay, I will go talk to the therapist and figure out what's going on. And what is PTSD? Well, what do people go to and talk about? Because I think I'm just reacting normal in everyday situations. And after talking to her, she was like, well, you have sleep disorders, you have nightmares, you have anxiety, you have depression. You have all of these in this checklist that you filled out. You have 8 out of 10 symptoms of PTSD. You have some pretty gnarly stuff going on and a lot of deployments that you probably haven't processed. And I was like, okay, well, what do we do now? And so we just started entering into our therapy program, a protocol of therapy. And after several months of doing that, or a couple months of doing that, I started to enjoy my job again, because I used to hate going into work and doing jumps and dives and, just everyday training of like, oh, I got to do this again. And it was just grinding on me. I was just getting like, I didn't want to do it. And now I'm starting to enjoy it again. And so I was the team leader of a group of guys who set up a training trip out to Boise, Idaho, feeling great, ready to do some climbing. It was a morale trip. And while we're out there, the goal was to train up a couple of new PJs to the team. Not that they were new as PJs, but they were newer to the team that I was at. And they are very experienced climbers, very good at what they do. And we had two inexperienced climbers. And the goal was to practice lead climbing, get these inexperienced climbers out, and just really build this team up of cohesiveness and team building. And so it was a great trip. But halfway through the trip, one of our guys set up an anchor and a rappel line, set up a rappel line with an anchor in the rock. So he placed a piece of a camming device, which just uses pressure against the rock to keep it in place. And a nut device, which uses friction and being able to wedge itself in place. Very common equipment and very reliable equipment. And so we set up the rappel line. First guy goes down the rappel. Goes down smooth, no problem, no issues. And I hadn't made it up to the top yet. Finally made it to the top. Second guy starts his rappel. And I hadn't checked the line, but knowing that our first guy went down, I was like, that's probably good. Asked the other guys, like, yeah, it's really good. It's good to go. We're set. Second guy starts his rappel. It's about halfway down. And that anchor, or the rock that the anchor is in, fails. The rock shatters. And so one side fails and the other, next one gives and it pops out. And so that second guy falls about 30 feet and hits the rocks below. And one of our other guys was tied into the anchor at the top. So doing what he was supposed to do. It's what he was trained to do. The weight of that individual pulled the other one off the very top. So two people fell. One fell 70 feet, the other one fell 30 feet. So I watched him slide by me, fly out, laying onto the ground below, bounce over to his face. And so I've lost a lot of friends in combat and accidents and other things. This one was very different, watching your friend fall that far down and being a team leader, feeling the responsibility of everything and knowing, okay, now I have to do my job of saving his life. And so we all got down there to him. We started doing our best to treat him, all of us as a team together, doing CPR, placing a surgical airway, doing a field chest tube, thinner thoracotomy. So just a chest tube without the tube, draining out the blood. So we worked on him for about 25 minutes. And after working on him, ultimately the fire department got there and pronounced him dead at the scene. And so that was one of the hardest phone calls I ever had to make, when I had to call on my boss and tell him what happened and that our teammate just fell and passed away. And knowing that the entire squadron's about to learn that one of our teammates just fell and passed away. And it was a training trip that I was the team leader of. So that sent me right into a depression of, you know, I don't have confidence in myself as a leader. I don't have confidence in myself as a medic. I couldn't save him. I couldn't do anything. Felt helpless. In all of those incidents of losing friends and teammates all piled on. Like, this was it. This was a straw that broke everything, and I was broken. And so I pulled myself off the team. I even tried to quit at one point, pulled myself off the team, and started working with the therapist again and other modalities of treatment that we had available to us, physical therapy, strength conditioning, nutrition, just really trying to work on a new foundation of who I was. After about 2.5 months of therapy and working on those things, I came back as the team leader. We deployed and I was the team leader of the same group of guys. And it was a very successful deployment. Nobody lost, no casualties. Regained my confidence. I felt good as a team leader again. Still working through the trauma, but I felt confident in what I was doing. And a couple months after coming back from that deployment, we were getting ready to deploy again. And so there was only a 2.5 month turnaround. But at the end of, right before we deployed, the accident investigation, safety investigation that took place for the accident finished and closed out. And they said, ultimately, there's nothing that we could have done to prevent what happened. There's nothing we could have done to change the outcome. So essentially, pretty much we're alleviating the fault, the blame, or the guilt that we felt. However, the military had to hold somebody accountable, and they held me accountable as the team leader. And I was removed from my position as team leader, and I was also removed from the unit that I worked really hard to get, because this unit, we had to do another selection and another year of training just to get operational. So this is the only place I wanted to be. I'm getting kicked out. Not only am I getting kicked out, I have 30 days to PCS and leave. And I'm being isolated from everybody in the squad. I'm being told I have to remove my gear from my cage and my locker, all of our stuff, 16 years of my life. I'm being told I have to remove all that by myself on a weekend so that nobody else can see. So this was pretty devastating. It was a dark time for me. I was depressed, and I only have 30 days to pack things up and figure things out. And I thought, man, if I go through with this and I PCS, I'm going to lose the therapy modalities and the resources I have. I'm going to go back to a regular unit that doesn't have the same quality of care. And they're not going to know why I'm even showing up or what's happening. And the new unit, the gaining unit, was going to be in Vegas, Las Vegas. Yeah, that already caused problems in my past, you know, with my relationship and my family. And I thought, this ain't going to work out. This is not good for me as a person and for my family. I can't do this. I'm going to have to pursue a medical retirement just so I don't go down a pathway that's going to ultimately end my family, you know, who I am and who's really there for me. So without a plan, with having no clue what I'm going to do next, I chose to medically retire with a diagnosis of PTSD and TBIs, and got out. You know, as I started approaching my 10-year out of the military, I started to realize, again, I'm going to lose other resources, but now I'm a little bit more prepared to lose those. What's going to be next? How do I keep myself functioning at the way I've been functioning? And started looking at all the different things and resources available when you get out, and I'm going to be treated, you know, just as any other veteran. I'm going to be stuck to the VA system. I'm going to be having to reach out to different nonprofit organizations to figure it out and tie things together. But nothing was ever a one-stop shop like it was at my unit. So that's what led to the idea of creating and replicating what I had at the unit and reaching out to different individuals to ask if they'll join me in the effort to creating something like this. And there the inception of Shields and Stripes was created.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question as you're talking about that. Where did the idea for Shield and Stripe come from? But, you know, it sounds like you're trying to basically just recreate the support system that you had in place while you were in that unit, and you had, you know, the physical, the mental side all covered all through the types of services that were available to you there. And so let's talk about the program that you have set up with Shields and Stripes and what that program entails and what someone can expect when they take part in the program.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, like you said, I wanted to replicate what was already available. I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. And this wasn't a one-off like idea of like, oh, maybe this can work. I know this works. This model works. I've used it. My friends have used it. We've all used this, and it's saved a lot of lives. And how do we get it to people? And this is the model is the POTUS, for the Preservation of the Force and Family, in SOCOM, in Special Operations, and it's available to most Special Operations units, and it's not very well used or utilized the right way. So ideally, what we have done, or what we wanted to replicate, is having a strength conditioning coach available, having a dietitian available to create a nutrition plan, meals available, having physical therapists, having occupational therapists, and having psychologists all working under one roof. So you don't have to go from one place to the next, you have to drive to one place and go to the hospital here, go to a clinic here, go to a gym here. It's all inside of a performance center. So how do we do that? What's the timeline? We host it inside of, right now, a performance center in Phoenix, Arizona, and Pensacola, Florida. And that company we use and contract out is called EXOS, or formerly known as API, Athletes Performance Institute. Now, they typically work with NFL athletes, NFL combine prep, pro athletes, you know, whether it be baseball, NHL, MLS, that's what their typical demographic is. And we in SOCOM had a program through the Eagle Front to be able to use their facilities for physical rehab. Having developed that relationship, I asked, can we use your facility for this particular program with Shields and Stripes? And they agreed. And so we have an agreement with them to host our demographic inside of their facility for 3 weeks. So they get top-notch, world-class strength conditioning coaches. They have world-class physical therapists. They have a dietitian or nutritionist there. We bring in our own dietitian. They have meals made on site for them. And we also fly in and bring our psychologist and occupational therapist where they get stress management, classes, education, sleep, hygiene education, and work on individual group therapy. And then you have different modalities of recovery inside that facility. So all of that's happening over a 3-week period. And they're also staying inside of a resort, a 5-star resort hotel. So when they go back home or back into their, where they're staying, it's also a world-class facility where they're just treated the way that they're supposed to be treated. They're treated like a professional athlete, and there's healing in that. There's healing in being able to, like, I don't have to think about anything. And essentially, this is a reset. Like, here's what right looks like. We're resetting you, developing a new foundation. And then when you leave there, it's not over. It's, you still have another 9 weeks of telehealth therapy. Then you go home to where you came from, to your family. And now we include the family and you have the same services available. We still have a telehealth strength conditioning coach. Only this time we're using the gym that's available to you, whether it's in your house or a gym that you pay for, or a gym at work. What's available? How do you approach the same objectives that you had in the facility? We have the dietitian still working with you, and only now we're looking at what's inside your pantry or your in your kitchen, and how do we develop the meals that's sustainable for you to reach the goals that you need to reach or that you've set aside for yourself. And then we have a physical therapist that still works on telehealth and been able to work through different exercises to work through the injuries that you had. And then now you're just doing it at home, you know, with him or her on the virtual call, just like this. And then we have our therapists that are still do the virtual telehealth. And now we include the family to here's what they're going through, here's what happened, and also documenting all of it and making sure that we do our due diligence to make sure that everything's taken care of. So if they do pursue something, here's a way out of the military, or if they are out, here's some documentation where they can take to their local provider. And that's a full 3-month program. And so we do that. We bring them in. We bring in eight per cohort. And right now with our funding, we're only able to hold 2 cohorts a year. And there's a reason why we do 8, because we want it very individualized. We want it to be very personable, making sure that each individual has a very direct contact and it's built specifically for them. If we bring in too many, then the quality of care goes down. However, we do want to expand the ability to use other sites. So the goal is to be able to host 4 programs a year. So hosting 32 a year in the next 2 years, and then double that in the next 5 years. And then hopefully over time, be able to host thousands inside of different facilities all over the United States. And we bring in veterans, active duty members, first responders, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMTs. That the only qualifications that they need to have is that they received some sort of trauma through service, and that's affected their day-to-day life. We don't require a diagnosis or anything like that. We just have to have served, whether it's public service or through the DOD, and had some sort of traumatic incident that's affected your day-to-day life.
Yeah, so it seems pretty comprehensive, and I love that it's not just limited to veterans or service members. It's you're opening up to the first responders, police, fire, EMTs, and those types of people as well, because let's face it, I mean, some of those people on a daily basis, they are being exposed to traumatic incidents, whether it's things like car accidents or fires or you name it, any number of things, homicides that they have to go and take care of. A lot of people, we don't really think about those types of things. There's somebody else who takes care of those things. Well, those people are those somebody else's. And that's a lot to handle for any one person. So, having those things available to those people is, I think, wonderful that you've opened it up to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, if I can say a couple of things with that.
Yeah.
Well, in that regard is, as I mentioned, my dad spent 30 years in law enforcement and growing up that way. And as I started to experience my PTSD symptoms, I started to relate myself to him and how he was when I was growing up. And I started to go, man, him and I are exactly alike. And he had significant PTSD that he didn't know he had, and it was just normal, and it was normalized for him. And what we tend to see more often than not is the first responder community is very quick to say, well, I don't, like, man, like, I've never experienced what you experienced. So I've had some things, but like, man, I couldn't imagine going through what you go through. And I was like, man, like, I also can't imagine what you went through, because it doesn't have to be in combat. Your trauma doesn't have to be a combat related incident. It, you know, what's just as traumatic as going in and to a domestic dispute call and the kids have been killed by the parents, or showing up to a car accident where the entire family is just obliterated in, you know, a high speed car accident, or, you know, the house fire in there, the family's burned alive inside and you have to carry the bodies out. And those are very traumatic instances that stick with you forever. And that's not normal. That's not a normal thing that we should experience. And not only that, are you picking up, like, getting those things on you and in your brain and seeing those things. And then you're going to go home, then you do the dishes, and you're going to, you know, pick up the dog poop or whatever. Like, you're going to do the laundry, and it's all that's playing in your head, and you start to distance yourself. And so the comparison should, although it happens more often than not, it should never take place, you know, because sexual assault trauma is just as traumatic and terrifying, if not more, than a combat related trauma. And that trust is taken away. And so all of those types of traumas are qualified to come through our program. And it's huge that people know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great point that you made, and something that I think for the listeners who may be listening, you know, you may be hearing stories like Steven's story, and you maybe hear other people's stories and it's like, well, I don't have it as bad as that person, so maybe I don't deserve this type of treatment. I'll let somebody else take it. But, you know, I've made this analogy before on this show. If somebody drowns in 5 feet of water, or if they drown in 30 feet of water, at the end of the day, they both drowned. It doesn't mean one drowned worse than the other. They both drowned, right? So, like, you might be dealing with something, for the listeners, you might be dealing with something, and you may be like, oh yeah, but that person's got it worse. Both have something crappy going on in your lives. Like, and you need to work on that to improve yourself and get yourself better. Yeah, maybe someone else went through something that was super traumatic, but it doesn't mean that your trauma is any less relevant or less valid than that person. So, you know, don't do that to yourself and just say, oh, well, someone else take my spot, and, you know, I'm not going to bother getting involved with this type of thing, because there's always somebody else worse out there. You know, it, quite frankly, you're probably worse than somebody else too. So, you know, somebody else is maybe doing that same thing and leaving that seat open for you to take advantage of this type of service. So, you know, definitely I am saying this to encourage people to reach out and get involved with Shields and Stripes and other organizations that are out there that do similar things, because, you know, there is real healing to be had there. And, you know, if you take advantage of it, you're going to experience that. But if you just let that opportunity slip by, then you're not going to see the benefits that you could be seeing, right?
Yep. No, absolutely. And to that point of, I think what's wild and really cool to see is when these individuals that go through the program, all of them have very different backgrounds. You have police officers, firefighters, you have men, women, you have different traumatic experience that have gone through very different things. However, their symptoms are all very similar. And when one starts talking about, yeah, like, I can't sleep at night because of this thing, well, I can't sleep either. You know, like, I, you know, fly off the handle when this happens, like, oh, so why? All these things, all the symptoms are very similar. The dreams might be different. The nightmares might be different. But when they're sitting in a hot tub, and we call it hot tub therapy at the hotel, and they're just talking to each other, that's extremely powerful. This peer network is also developed of commonality. Like, it's no longer viewed as, oh, you're worse than I am, or you have, you're a police officer, I'm a firefighter, you're a veteran, you've been in combat, I haven't. Like, this, everyone's equals, and they all have, and they're all trying to build each other up. And some have good days and some have bad days, and everybody's ready to carry each other along just to get to the finish line.
Yeah. And to that point, while your story and my story are completely different stories, when you started talking about some of the things that you experienced some of the, you know, quick to get angry and basically yelling, you know, at your kids or forgetting people and places, things that have taken place in your life. I heard a lot of my symptoms or my story coming out in what you were saying there too. So, I mean, that just goes to show, I mean, this was not planned in any way. Before today, we hadn't even spoken to each other. And so, like, it's not like we had much, you know, time to plan that out to get that out there. But that's, I mean, I've written about it in my book. Anyone wants to grab a copy of my book and read that, it's there. So it's not like I'm making this up. You know, all of that stuff is out there. So, you know, I can see how that can happen, where you're going to get people with different backgrounds, you know, like a firefighter and a police officer. Typically, they're like Red Sox and Yankees fans. They're like going after each other, right? Not like the best of friends. But when you get them together in an environment like this, they start to see, okay, well, you know, this guy's got the same thing that I'm going through, and, you know, start to humanize the people a little bit more, and you start to understand what it is that they're going through, and maybe even a little bit about what your own journey is going through as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's all great points. Yeah.
So like any nonprofit out there, I'm sure you're looking for donations or even people to volunteer their time and stuff that they might be able to help out with, especially with regards to expanding to other locations. Where can people go to get involved and see how they can help out Shields and Stripes?
Easy. So to help out, yeah, absolutely. If you want to www.shieldsandstripes.org, you can see some of the videos of the folks that have gone through the program. It's my story. It's on a video there. It's also got some YouTube links. And then we have a way to donate or to apply. So what helps out, obviously, it costs money to put these people through the program. They don't have to do anything. There's no cost to them. We fly them out there. We pay for their travel, pay for their lodging, and their all their services provided over the 3-month period. It's about $15,000 to put an individual through this program. So all the money that comes in, all of it goes towards this program and putting these people through there. None of us are paid. There's no salaries that we're taking out of this. I don't get paid out of this. The goal is to put as many people through the program as possible. And I'll venture to say, I know that at least 50% of the people that have gone through the program have had a previous attempt at taking their own life. And that's huge. And if you look at that, you know, statistics, there's probably a lot more than that just throughout the entire nation. So the other way of being able to help out is to share this information with families and friends or people that you know. If any of the symptoms that we described here today, you know, if they remind you of any particular person that you know, and they might hear the message inside of this and open their mind as I did, and you go, man, like maybe this is an opportunity for them to change some things in their lives, I would appreciate you sharing the websites, sharing the story with them, sharing what we're doing with those individuals. And that message alone, carrying that message to people that we can change their lives, is incredibly valuable. Sharing the message to people that have the capacity, the financial capacity to help us get more into the program. Because like I said, we're only limited by funding to be able to make more of these programs possible. And then volunteer opportunities. We do host events inside of different states, mostly Arizona and North Carolina, because those are big footprints in the areas low as Phoenix, Arizona, and just outside of the Fort Bragg area. We typically host events down there to raise funds. So there are opportunities to come, you know, either pass out flyers, volunteer at beats, things like that will help out. But I think the biggest way to affect the individuals going through the program is to be able to donate, you know, no dollars too small. You know, $10 helps, you know, in up to $1,000 helps, or whatever, it goes a long way. So there's ways to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I will have links to the website in the show notes so that people can go find that to make those donations and find out about some of the events that you have going on and how they might be able to help out with that. And also for the people who want to get involved in the program that you offer, you know, they can visit the website as well. You said there's an application there to fill out on there. So, you know, for the listeners, if you're looking to help out and donate, go to the website. Also, if you're looking to get involved in and participate in the program that Shields and Stripes has to offer, go check out the website as well. Everything seems like it'll be right there, and we'll have that link in the show notes for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Feel free to email the email address provided on the website. Yeah, that's how we're able to communicate with a lot of people that do want to volunteer opportunities or have opportunities or questions. There's a contact email address that we can reach out to you. So feel free to use that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Stephen, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. Really enjoyed the conversation. And I also want to thank you for all that you're doing for the veteran and the first responder communities that, you know, desperately need to be served. I feel like they're definitely underserved. And the more people like you who are out there who are serving them, it's only going to make things better for all of these people involved. So thank you again.
Well, thank you for having me and thank you for your service. And hopefully we can continue to save more lives.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.